his book, The Invisible Caring Hand, American Congregations and the Provision of Welfare, published by the New York University Press in 2002, Ram A. Kanan wrote that if the average North American congregation were to bill its community for the social services it provides, the tab would be about $184,000 per year. I think that statistic reveals just the tip of the iceberg of good that Christianity has offered to society over the past 2,000 years. Of course, we can think of things that the church has done wrong and ways that it has hurt society. But if you think about it, the church has also been responsible for beginning and continuing to operate the vast majority of hospitals and schools around the world. Not to mention the positive influence that the church has had on art and literature and so much else. And all of this, I think, well, it started with Jesus, didn't it? Jesus, who said, "The Son of Man came not to be served, but to serve, and to give His life as a ransom for many." And that service mentality was part of the heartbeat of the first group of Christians in Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. Let us read once again Luke's wonderful description of that group from Acts chapter 2, verses 42 through 47. "They devoted themselves to the apostles' teaching and fellowship, to the breaking of bread and the prayers. Awe came upon everyone, because many wonders and signs were being done by the apostles. All who believed were together and had all things in common. They would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all, as any had need. Day by day, as they spent much time together in the temple, they broke bread at home and ate their food with glad and generous hearts, praising God and having the goodwill of all the people. And day by day, the Lord added to their number those who were being saved." Today we're focusing on the fourth of the five purposes of the church described in this passage, and that is service. And I think we see at least four points about Christian service here. First, all who believed were together and they had all things in common. Now, of course, the first question this raises is, did the first Christians in Jerusalem eliminate private property? If all of them were here today, would they vote for Bernie Sanders? I don't know. But as far as private property is concerned, I think the answer is no. The reason I believe the answer is no, because we read in this same passage that they sold their possessions and goods and distributed the proceeds to any as he or she had need. The tense of the verb that's used here is imperfect. It means that the selling and the giving were occasional in response to specific needs. It was not a once-for-all renunciation of private property. After all, in this same passage, we read that the first Christians in Jerusalem broke bread at home, so that they all continued to have their individual homes. What is described here is really much more of an attitude. It's an attitude that says, "What's mine is yours." What we see here is a willingness to share that goes beyond the norm. But secondly, we need to note that this attitude was expressed in action. We read they would sell their possessions and goods and distribute the proceeds to all as any had need. It was a voluntary sharing. but it was expressed in action. The first Christians in Jerusalem were apparently willing to do whatever was required to meet the needs of others. It's emphasized again in Acts chapter 4. There was not a needy person among them. For as many as owned lands or houses sold them and brought the proceeds of what was sold, they laid it at the apostles' feet, and it was distributed to each as any had need. So we see that these first Christians, they even from time to time sold properties, sold possessions to meet the needs of others with the proceeds. But their sharing didn't stop there. Thirdly, we read that they shared food with one another in their homes in gladness and simplicity of heart, as it's sometimes translated. That word simplicity, sometimes translated as generosity, I think that's key. The only way we will ever have anything to share with others is if we live more simply ourselves. Finally, we should notice the result of the first church's service. They had the goodwill of all the people. Their attitudes and actions of service led to a positive reputation with those outside the church. I remember many years ago, as a young person, I think I was in my 20s at the time, and I was on a cross-country flight from the East Coast to the West, and I was sitting next to a New York Wall Street businessman. And I was enthusiastic about my faith and wanted to share about Jesus with him, and I attempted to do that. He wasn't interested in hearing any of it. Didn't want to know about any of my Christianity. Tried to shut me up in some nice ways. Until I shared with him my father's story of coming to faith in Jesus Christ out of organized crime and eventually ending up in New York City, not in the nice section where this man had an office, but in Spanish Harlem, trying to reach teenage gangs with the good news of Jesus and starting a school there. Finally, he was interested and respectful. And he said, "That's the way we all should live. Your father set a good example." It reminds me of the saying, "People don't care how much we know until they know how much we care." And when they see that, oftentimes it wins a hearing for the good news of Jesus. But it raises the question, how are we to follow the example of the first church in Jerusalem in regard to service? And one answer to that question is found in a memorable phrase coined by Ruth Stafford Peale, the wife of Norman Vincent Peale, a great influence in my life as a young person, the pastor and author of that best-selling book, The Power of Positive Thinking. His wife Ruth apparently coined the phrase, "Find a need and fill it." I think that's a great motto for any church. I hope we make it our motto. We need to be asking ourselves and others, what are the needs in our church? What are the needs in our community? And how might we go about meeting those needs? One way I know this church is meeting needs is every Sunday morning, the food we collect, and that gets distributed through Food Share to needy people in our community. Since moving here, I've heard about the homeless problem, even in this beautiful county with so many beautiful homes. I think it was in my first week here that a homeless person came into the church in need. We were able to do just a little bit for him, providing a room for the night. But there's so much more that needs to be done, and many Christians in this community are gathering together and trying to put together a homeless shelter, because there isn't one at present in our county. And yet there are some 200 people in our county who are homeless. So that's a need. Perhaps it's a need we can step in to meet. Finding needs and filling them. Finding hurts and healing them. That's what our church should be about. But before we can find needs and fill them, before we can find hurts and heal them, I think we have to do something else. We have to discover our own gifts and begin to use them. You know, I've been asked more than once since I've come here. I think actually at first it came up in one of the interviews before I came here, and I've heard other people pose this question in various ways. What would you do if such and such a person came to you with such and such a need? How would you respond to it? Well, kind of the same way I responded to that homeless man who came in during my first week here. I actually didn't have much time to talk to him at that moment. I tried to hear his story, and then I kind of cut to the chase and I said, "What is your greatest need right now?" And he said, "I need a place to stay tonight." And I thought about what resources I might have, what resources the church might have. And then I said, I think we can do something to meet that need. And we did. I think that's just a natural sort of process of ministry. There's lots of needs out there. Maybe I can't meet them all, but maybe there's somebody in our church community who can. And so it takes an awareness of what gifts we have together to share with others. And so, as I promised in the quest this week, that's kind of the end of the sermon. The spoken one, anyway. I want you to help me enact this sermon, though, and just take a little step in the direction we need to go. And that is discovering our spiritual gifts. And then beginning to use them. But discovery is the first step. And so in your bulletin this morning, you may have noticed there's this survey, a spiritual gifts assessment. And I've done this myself. And you may look at this and think, oh my goodness, there's 64 questions here. Well, I filled it out myself just to test, and it took me 10 minutes. And somebody said to me, well, you've done this sort of thing before, so that was kind of fast. So I tested it out on my wife. She did it in 6 minutes. So if you would, please take a moment now. Write your name at the top. That's the first thing. And I'm going to go around with pencils if anybody needs something to write with. These questions, yes, they provoke some thought, but really your best answer is the first answer that comes to mind. These are descriptive phrases. If they describe you extremely well, put a 5 next to it. If it doesn't describe you at all, put a 1 next to it. If you're somewhere in between, put a 2, a 3, or a 4. One little story in closing comes from the book Outliers by Malcolm Gladwell. And he tells the story of Christopher Langan, a genius with a staggering IQ of 195. For some perspective on that, Einstein's IQ was 150. During high school, Langan could ace any foreign language test just by skimming the textbook 2 to 3 minutes before the exam. Got a perfect score on his SAT, even though at one point he fell asleep. But Langan failed to use his exceptional gifts to their full potential. Ended up working on a horse farm in rural Missouri. According to Gladwell, Langan never had one important thing, a community to help him capitalize on his gifts. Gladwell summarizes the story of Langan in one sentence. Langan had to make his way alone. And no one, not rock stars, not professional athletes, not software billionaires, and not even geniuses, ever make it alone. The church is not simply a collection of disconnected individuals. The church is not about helping people make it alone. Rather, the church is a place where we pool our God-given talents and gifts all together, and then we use those gifts in service to God, God's kingdom, and our community.